Again, just for those of you who've never been here before, we've just started the recording. So we'll make a recording, then we're going to be sending you the recording. We also have about 800 people on our board of directors talent bank around the world, and they will get a copy of this recording as well. So just be careful who you're insulting. I'd like to introduce you Bill Johnson. Bill is assistant professor of finance at the Sawyer Business School at Suffolk University. He previously worked for Teledyne and then Tyco Electronics in engineering and sales positions. Bill has a BS in engineering at Rensselaer Polytech and then an MBA from University of Buffalo and a PhD in finance from Michigan State University. In addition to his work at Suffolk, he is research associate at the Center for Venture Research at the University of New Hampshire. And Bill, maybe before you get into your prepared remarks, you might tell the group what is the Center for Venture Research. So let me set you up with this. Let me just make sure. Okay, you're all set.
All right, thank you, Larry. Am I to sit in the hot seat?
Yeah,
okay. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm very excited to be here, and I will take a couple minutes, if it's okay, to talk about my background. As Larry said, I have sort of a different background from many academics. If it's all right, I think I may sit. My background actually lends itself well to sort of understanding the way companies work. I've worked for several small companies. The smallest company I worked for was a company that was eventually acquired by AMP, which became part of Tyco, a $100 million company in sales. And the largest company I worked for, I guess, was Tyco. Last year, I received an award for a paper that examines the corporate governance of firms, and most of the academic literature up until recently has said that when shareholders have fewer rights in the firm, it destroys firm value, and there's a lot of academic work to support that, and actually a lot of the work going on around that in terms of ISSI, Institutional Shareholder Services, which you may be familiar with, they've been encouraging companies to de-stagger their boards. ISS makes recommendations to institutional shareholders about how they should vote on proxies. CalPERS, California Public Retirement System, has been encouraging firms to remove anti-takeover provisions. Lucian Bebchuk at Harvard has also been encouraging, very active in encouraging removal of staggered boards and these kinds of things. So my paper was very unique in that what it said is that for small companies, for in particular the firms that I'm looking at are IPO companies, having certain types of anti-takeover provisions can actually increase firm value. And the reason this happens is that the firm is in a very dangerous position when it first goes public in that it can be acquired very easily, and all of its partnerships with other firms are open to renegotiation in that kind of a situation. I'll give you an example of a specific firm in my sample before I actually get down to some specific comments and questions I have for you guys and discussion topics. There's a firm in my sample called Kanar Technologies. When it went public in 2000, it had a staggered board. It would be very difficult to acquire. At the same time, most of its product, over 30% of its sales, were to one customer, which is Boeing. So when Kanar goes public, Boeing has to be very concerned that Kanar becomes a takeover target of Boeing's competitors. It becomes a takeover target of other firms that might like the technology that Kanar has. And Boeing has a strong relationship with Kanar, which basically would be renegotiated in the case that KNR becomes a takeover target. And so the focus of my paper is really on what types of relationships, be they customer-supplier relationships or strategic alliance relationships, what types of relationships would cause these anti-takeover provisions to be particularly important for small IPO firms. So Larry asked specifically about the Center for Venture Research at the University of New Hampshire. I am an associate there, and what that center does is it examines the funding of small firms, usually in the pre-IPO stage, in terms of angel investors and venture capital investors, and how firms get capital in order to run. So I have, I guess, two papers co-authored with several other people there. So a lot of my research is on early stage funding of firms, but I'm very excited to be talking about corporate governance because these things all definitely fit together. So I want to make a comment about the general trend in staggered boards. We could talk about other anti-takeover provisions like poison pills, but most of the literature suggests the important one is staggered boards, because if you have a staggered board, the board can always adopt other anti-takeover provisions. And these are really the ones, the staggered boards are the things that Lucian Bebchuk at Harvard and some of the other academics, as well as the Institutional Shareholder Services, has said, we got to get rid of these. Just to give you some background, in 2002, 302 of the S&P 500 had staggered boards. Okay, so that's 11 years ago. Last year, I haven't looked through the data to see this year, but last year, as of last year, 126 of the S&P 500 had staggered boards. So we went through about 60% of S&P 500 firms with staggered boards to about 25%. Okay, so it's a very obvious trend. A lot of this is driven by CalPERS, by ISS, by these guys at Harvard in de-staggering boards. So my first question, if it's all right, that I wanted to sort of open up, and I'm going to pick on Michael DeMarco, if I may, or ask him for his thoughts, since he is a board member on a mutual fund.
That's a target, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm interested to know why institutions dislike staggered boards so much, and sort of get discussion started on that and go from there.
Bill, I was actually sitting here thinking about kind of the other side of the coin.
Okay.
I was thinking about the situation you described with the Boeing supplier, and whether the terms of their arrangement were not particularly advantageous to Boeing because of its size and its ability to dominate the company, and maybe the arrangement wasn't particularly in the interest of the shareholders of the small company. And what Boeing is really afraid of is, an equilibrium where the arrangements are more objective and arm's length rather than, reflecting a power imbalance of a very tiny supplier and a behemoth customer.
So let me address that in two parts. The first part of my answer is, KNR was treated as a private firm in a very in a shocking way, and I'll give you an example. If you read through their prospectus actually says, as a private firm, Boeing had a right to show up at KNR's plant and ask for not. Remember now, KNR is private. Demand not just all the accounting statements, balance sheet, income statement, cash flow statement, but also all the credit lines they had drawn on, all the banking arrangements. So when KNR was private, Boeing could show up, and it actually says within, I don't recall if it's 24 or 48 hours, demand all of this information in a way that, public investors, if I show up at a public firm, they have a full quarter. I can ask them for the data, but an institutional shareholder might not be given that data except on a quarterly basis. So as a private firm, KNR was clearly in the pocket, so to speak, of Boeing. Boeing, there was a power imbalance. In the research that I did in this paper that I was looking at, we directly tested the relationship in terms of power imbalance between these large customers. They tend to be firms like Walmart and Boeing and General Motors, okay, so very powerful firms, and these small firms like KNR, who I imagine no one in the room had heard of them before I mentioned them. We didn't find a lot of evidence of there being a power imbalance, so one of the things we did is to look to see if our results were stronger when the firm was larger, when the customer was larger. So Boeing's extremely large in our sample, GM is extremely large, Walmart's extremely large, they would have a lot of power. We didn't find that the anti-takeover provisions were destructive to the supplier, to Kanar, right? In a sense, what you'd be saying is Boeing wants the anti-takeover provisions because Boeing got a sweet deal with Kanar, and by putting those in place, it can keep its sweet deal. That would actually imply that the anti-takeover provisions would destroy value, and we don't actually find that. We find that they increase firm value. Okay. Now, on the flip side, we also find that the anti-takeover provisions increase firm value for Boeing as well, which is why our conclusion is that protecting Kanar from the takeover market protects Kanar. It also protects the customers of Kanar, such as Boeing.
All right. So we'll come back to the question you posed to me. Okay. Well, it seems to me that if the case were as you described it, then the situation would be that a security is not trading at fair value. It's trading significantly, there's a significant discount to fair value. So a potentially dissident shareholder would like the opportunity to take a control stake in the shares of the firm and impose leverage on the management decision-making process to try to release that value, which they could then harvest.
Okay, so
and that's hard to do with a staggered board.
Right. So let me make a comment about whether or not things are trading at fair value. So I mentioned these statistics about the S&P 500 going from 60% staggered boards to about 25% staggered boards today. If you look at the IPO market, it's gone the exact opposite direction. So for IPO firms, more and more firms are staggered. In the sample in my paper, which ends in 2005, about 65% of IPO firms have staggered boards. Today, for data in 2012, it's about 86% of IPO firms. So that implies one of two things. Either the IPO firms are undervalued because they have these staggered boards and they shouldn't, or the staggered boards are creating value, or they're there for a good reason, and they're actually not destroying value by adopting these staggered boards. The other issue that's important to remember for IPO firms is the shareholders are very concentrated at the time of the IPO. So before a firm goes public, there might only be 10 shareholders of the IPO firm. Sometimes there are hundreds, but very often, very few people own large stakes in the IPO firm. So those 10 investors have every incentive to maximize the value of the firm. So it's a little puzzling if IPO firms are adopting these staggered boards, why they would be doing that if, in fact, the staggered boards destroy value.
Well, I mean, it occurs to me that dealing with shareholder initiatives is something that very small firms have very limited capacity to address, because you've got a handful of principles that are central to the success of the business, and they only have so many hours in the day, so to speak, whereas a large institutionalized enterprise like a member of the Fortune 500 is adequately resourced, that they've got the ability to kind of walk and chew gum. Whereas
right.
If you were looking instead at the S&P 500 over the last 5 years, if you look, let's say, at the Russell 2000, you might see something more akin to what you're describing for the IPO population. If you look at where regulatory impact tends to be, I don't want to be too pejorative and call it destructive, but if you look at the institutions where the increasing involvement of our government over the last 6 years has been focused, it's been a lot heavier to bear by small enterprises than by the GEs and the Intels and the JP Morgans of the world. They can deal with the government.
Sure.
So what's perplexing to me in the question, right, is as an academic exercise, right, and I don't say that in any adverse fashion, but as an academic exercise, look at staggered boards and values over time, right, you'll you get a difference, right? Well, let's accept that. But at the time of an IPO, for example, you have a stock that is being sold by the underwriter. And who would assign, who in the marketplace would assign that difference in value because the board is staggered or not staggered? And with, and I haven't done this study, but with the exception of a company that was mature and in play, meaning it was an acquisition takeover target or should be, I'm not sure I've ever seen an analyst report that said, oh, and by the way, they don't have a staggered board, which is probably going to be better for value over the next 30 years. I've never, who assigns the value? Who even knows?
So let me make one comment about governance provisions, anti-takeover provisions in general. There's a bit of research done by Michael Klausner at Stanford that says nothing matters at all. Poison pills don't matter. Blank check preferred doesn't matter. In fact, the only thing that matters is staggered boards, which is why I sort of started out talking specifically about staggered boards. In addition, he's told me, I've talked to him several times, and he's told me all these guys out in Silicon Valley, the venture capital guys, they don't care. They don't care at all whether they have staggered boards or not. So that raises another question. Nobody in the venture capital industry says that that matters at all. So who does care? Well, the institutions I mentioned before, CalPERS, Institutional Shareholder Services, these guys say it matters. There is some academic research by an academic at Harvard, Gompers, who has a paper with Joy Ishii and Metric. I can't remember Metric's first name, but they have a paper that says value is lower when you have anti-takeover provisions. But that raises the question of why would IPO firms be willing to destroy value when they're selling their shares for the first time?
I think it's a lot, the whole concept of staggered boards, or for that or any other, the takeover defense, really depends on how broad your shareholder base is. In the case of an IPO firm, and I'm including private equity firms that are coming back public, you still have a very concentrated shareholder base.
Right.
Okay, so the ability of a raider to come in and take a major stake in that company is reduced because there's much less float on the stock. Once your shareholder base gets broad, okay, then the issue of relative value to perceived value, which is what attracts raiders, is that you have a low trading stock, but the raider believes that there is an inherent value in the stock, and therefore it goes and takes a big position and start agitating. Okay, I was at Kidder Peabody in the early 1980s. We were the leading tender defense firm. We created a whole bunch of these any takeover provisions working with Marty Lipton and Wachtell Lipton.
Yeah.
Okay, we were the first ones to put a poison pill in.
Yep.
Okay, the concept was, especially in the early 80s when you still had a large bunch of legacy conglomerates out there, and at that point conglomerates were trading at a severe discount to the inherent value of their pieces, okay, that's when we made Carl Icahn a lot of money in Greenmail, because Carl would pick up that disparity of value, go in and attack, all right? Then the concept of takeover offense was really, how do you maximize value of your asset portfolio while still controlling your own destiny,
right.
Okay? Where CalPERS and the others have come out almost always is in the case of a disparate shareholder base. When stocks trade badly, like HP, for instance, all right, it took some, Walt Disney is a great example. In the early 1980s, it was trading like a dog. It was run like a dog. It was not a great organization. And then Roy Disney and his partner went in, had a stake, bought a bigger stake, went in, agitated on the board. It was not a staggered board. They went, took over the board, brought in Eisner and Katzenberg to run the thing, and they turned the thing around. All right, But it's a classic case where the stock, you know, management wasn't doing what it was supposed to be doing. Okay, CalPERS and the other major institutions, they themselves, you know, Fidelity would in its biggest piece would own 5 or 6% of a company. You can't influence even with that big a piece. CalPERS would maybe own 2 or 3% of a company. You still can't influence with that big enough piece. So they don't mind having raiders come in and do the agitating for them. For that, having takeover defenses is against what they want.
So let me make a comment about valuation or misvaluation, because that is an important thing. And I'm sorry, Neil, you asked a specific question about where do these valuations come from, and I missed getting the answer to your question. At the time of an IPO, a firm is the offer price is set by the underwriter. Now, I've talked to the CFO of a firm, Strider, when they went public. No, I'm sorry, Guidant. When they went public, their CFO actually came to my school when I was a PhD student, and I asked him, so where does the number come from? And he said, we did all this analysis, and we went to the underwriter, and we said, we think it's worth this much, and the underwriter said, nope, it's 8. 8? It's 8. So the underwriter has a huge amount of power, and that is related to Michael. Michael's comment as well about the power imbalance. The underwriter said, look, you want to go public, this is the number. That number that the underwriter comes up with, it comes from them doing the roadshow and talking to their investors and what they think they can sell it at as well. Because they don't want to try to sell a stock at 8 when nobody's going to buy it at 8. They want to sell it at 8 when everybody would be willing to pay 8 or even more than 8. Because they want investors to have a good taste in their mouth and that sort of thing. You know, they don't want to sell it at 8 and have it go down to 4. With regard to the difference between float, now that's an interesting question as well. IPO firms are, just before they go public, they have a very small number of shareholders, as you point out. After they go public, they still have a relatively small number of shareholders. A lot of the insiders are locked up. If I were the CEO and I owned 15% of the firm, I can't sell typically for 6 months or a year. So there's a block that's locked up. And then there might be, you know, several other founders, the venture capitalists, they all get locked up by agreement with the underwriter for between 6 months and a year.
6 months is standard.
In the US. So what that means is that the float also has an influence that you might have these anti-takeover provisions, but they don't really mean as much.
Well, the other is that in the IPO, if the underwriter has done what he wants to do, 30% of the stock that was sold to three institutions, each taking 10%. And then the rest of the IPO, so say you sell 30% of the company in the IPO, three institutions will pick up individually 3-4% of that stock, because they take up to 10% and may buy more stock in the aftermarket to get themselves to a position where they've got a significant block. Fidelity, and I'm talking about Fidelity, Wellington, Putnam, you know, basically large mutual fund institutions, you know, or pension plan institutions. That's the way an underwriter structures the deal. Okay, is he's going to sell hopefully 30% of his flock goes to three players, each taking 10% of the deal. So you still have a concentrated shareholder base. What happens after the 6 months is, yes, you know, especially if you got VCs, once their stock gets unlocked, what they do is distribute it out to their limiteds, and now you start getting a broader distribution of the stock. Then the anti-takeover provisions become interesting, because now you're getting a broader shareholder base.
Right. I absolutely agree with the dynamics that you're describing, that there is difficulty in having dispersion of shareholder holdings until, I would say, a year after the IPO. Nevertheless, there are still a lot of IPOs that are acquired very rapidly after going public. I don't know the 1 year.
Some that get acquired before they go public.
Yeah, many.
You file your S1, and guess what?
Somebody says, I like this.
And I'll give you more than what you're asking for in your IPO.
Yep. What I can say is that IPOs are still acquired. I think the number is about 30% of IPOs are acquired within 3 years. So they're still being acquired fairly rapidly. I don't know off the top of my head the statistic within 1 year. That would be an interesting statistic.
The key to the anti-takeover defense is the concept of hostile versus friendly takeovers. Okay? Board controlled versus uncontrolled takeovers. Read that as in a hostile situation, the board is trying to retain, the board of the target is trying to retain as much control as it can over the process. First goal is obviously if they think now is not the time to sell, the first decision a board's got to make is it now the time to sell or not? If you're in the beginning of a growth curve and you don't think your stock reflects that, now is not time to sell. If on the other hand, you've plateaued out and your stock is beginning to reflect that, now may be the time to sell. I mean, takeover defenses are used to control that timing, okay? Hostile shareholders, as I made the point, come in when they perceive value that the market is not perceiving. They force the board to make a decision that they may not want to make at that point. In the case of most IPOs, you know, a whole bunch of them being acquired within 3 years, I would almost guarantee you that 95% of those are friendly transactions, either orchestrated auctions by an investment banker or the logical buyer walks in with a price that makes logical sense and it's the board agrees to it and it's friendly and you come out with a merger statement.
It might be higher than 95%.
Yeah.
It's almost always friendly.
That's the key. The purpose of the anti-takeover provisions is to make it so that if there's a merger out there, it's control. The board of the target has some control in the negotiation, whereas in the case of the hostile, the board starts to lose control of the process, in part because one of the first things that happens in the hostile is a lot of that broad shareholder base hits for the hedge funds. All right, we're playing arbitrageurs on the deal, and you can end up with, if you had a float of 70% of your company, 40%, half that float would end up in the hands of transactional oriented shareholders as opposed to long-term shareholders. And at that point, you've lost control of the process.
Yeah.
So then you're killed.
Just a slowdown.
It's a slowdown function, yeah.
Just a process point. We have 5 minutes, then we'll have a stop. And anybody who needs to leave, wants to leave, can leave. Anybody who wants to continue the discussion with Bill, we'll do that.
Okay. There's another issue that I wanted to talk about, which I know several of you work at private firms that are backed by private equity funds and that sort of thing. And so one of the things that I think is interesting is to sort of think about when private firms are thinking about governance attributes, staggered boards or not. Generally, there's a much smaller takeover market for these, but maybe somebody who has experience on a private board can comment on where do they fit in terms of staggered boards or other types of provisions.
And also, you know, so many of you are also on nonprofit boards. Does any of this relate to nonprofits?
Our private equity board doesn't have anything staggered at all, but it's a small board.
But your shareholders, the board is your board.
Yeah, so there's no.
Yeah.
If he's got outside board members, it's because they got some industry experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've not seen staggered in venture-backed and private equity-backed companies. What you tend to see is by class, right? People have rights to appoint directors.
Sure.
You've got the A director, the B director, the founder. But in terms of a staggered, a third, a third, a third, I haven't seen that.
I'm wondering in the process of going from private to public, that's where it really matters, right? And so I don't know if any of you have ever experienced that private to public transition.
Look at it from a private equity's point of view. The difference between selling their portfolio company or taking it public is strictly a valuation issue.
Right.
Today, in today's stock market, it is more profitable to take the company public than to try to sell it privately. But in the case of at least one investment that I was involved with, that I was in, you know, limited in the deal, they filed the S-1. And the logical buyer immediately stepped up to the plate and said, I'll pay X. The S-1 didn't go anywhere, so we sold the company. Okay? And that happens occasionally for private companies trying to exit. But take his company, for instance, doing photo booths. That will get sold someday. Okay?
Sure.
There's some logical buyer out there that this is a good add-on to. It's not likely to become a public company,
right,
unless there really is a limited buyer pool, in which case they will take it public because it's a better value exit.
Yep.
But today, you know, if you're selling financial company, mid-sized companies, 500 million revenue type, its valuation today in the private market is 7 to 9x on the buy side. But in the public market, it's probably 12 to 14x
sure.
EBITDA. That's why you're going to get a better multiple going out public.
Yeah. Okay. The other issue I wanted to talk about is I'm interested to know everybody's thoughts on why there's a disparity between what's going on in the S&P 500. That these firms are all de-staggering, and sort of what's going on in these small firms. One of the things that I've always thought about is, I don't think it matters if Microsoft has a staggered board or not. I don't think anybody can take over Microsoft or ExxonMobil or, you know, any other number of firms. The debt market's not even big enough to consider these types of firms. So from that,
said that back in the RJR Nabisco's days, they thought that was too big to be done. It got done.
It did.
Nobody's too big. In my experience of anti-takeover conversations I've had with counsel, when you sort of go through the whole list,
right,
what can we do? The one thing you can't do is say, well, let's go from a unstaggered every year board to a third, a third, a third. Right? That you get sued for that.
Right.
And you can't do that as an anti-takeover provision. And so what's your rationale for doing it? I think what happens when you're private and deciding to do an IPO, you can do anything you want. What's the rationale from going from unstaggered to staggered? And how do you make the legal argument that that's really good for the shareholders?
Well, again, go back 20 years when this was the movement was happening, okay, or 30 years ago now. The 80s, almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I've been around here too long. Back then, you didn't have institutions, you know, CalPERS was quiet,
right.
You didn't have ISI out there,
yeah.
People fighting against the anti-takeover provisions. You still had to go to your shareholders to get approval to do a staggered board, but shareholders blindly signed the proxy and you got your staggered board.
Right. If you go pre-87, it probably doesn't matter anyway because there weren't hostile takeovers to begin with.
Well, there was the first hostile takeover was 1979.
Wouldn't there be
led by Morgan Stanley? So it was
okay.
So that was the first. In the early 80s was hostile takeover central. And I was involved in the funniest of them, which was the Pac-Man defense when Bendix went after Martin Marietta. And it turned out the voting dates were such that if Martin Marietta bought Bendix, they could take over Bendix before Bendix could take over Martin Marietta. So we did the Pac-Man defense. They launched a hostile tender on us. We turned around and launched a hostile tender on them.
Isn't there added value from staggering a board to have continuity of governance? So that you're not having a whole new class of people walking in and having no idea what the company's actually doing.
So a lot of academic research has looked at that and thought, well, maybe that's why this is a good idea. The problem with that particular argument is if you look at the board members of firms that don't have staggered boards, over 80%, it's probably over 95%, but I don't want to throw that number out. It's always the same board members. there's very little turnover in a board of a public company. And so from that perspective, it's sort of hard to argue that, well, we want these guys on the board year after year after year. Even without staggered boards, they're on the board year after year after year. So there really isn't that compelling argument to say it's because we want to keep, you know, stability on the board overall. At the same time, you know, you could argue that, well, when it really matters is when there's a takeover attempt, and that's when I want to have continuity. But once again, I think the academic literature and a lot of the industry practice has been that, look, these are just used to forestall or prevent takeovers of the firms, and it's really not about continuity or having the same team players on the firm.
Is it all about takeover and sort of ultimate sales value, or is there any indication that having a staggered board changes performance?
So the only research out there other than, I guess there are two papers that I can think of, mine and another one, that talks specifically about smaller firms. But in large firms, most of the research suggests that the stock returns are lower when you have staggered boards, and it also suggests that a measure we use in finance called Tobin's Q, which is the market value divided by the book value of the firm, is also lower when the firm has a staggered board. And, you know, finance guys will argue about endogeneity and all kinds of econometric, maybe it seems like nonsense to you guys, it's sort of important stuff, but it's hard to explain exactly what it all means. But in general, that's what academics suggest. For large firms, having staggered boards decreases the market value and decreases stock returns. I think there is some research that looks at operating performance, profit margins, and those kinds of things. And I think, in general, it shows very similar types of results, that these firms have lower operating performance as well. I'm not sure that there's as much support for that. But there's certainly very little evidence for large firms, say in the S&P 500, that they actually are able to create value or enhance operating performance or enhance stock performance for these firms.
I think you should slice it, take the Fortune S&P 100 out of your mix, because those are the very, very large market cap companies. And I'm not saying the KKRs of the world or the TPGs of the world or the Carlisles of the world can't take them over. But all three of those guys basically run on friendly basis only.
Right.
Okay. I think at one point KKR almost did an unfriendly. But other than that, these guys are strictly friendly players. And then they don't care whether it's a staggered board or not, because they're negotiating with the board on a friendly basis.
Right.
And the board either accepts or rejects their offer. And then they have to go shop clauses afterwards, okay? So that the board protects itself, knowing that the value that they agreed to is in fact the best value that the company could have achieved, okay? If you take the other 400 though in the S&P 500 and then do your research with that, just that quartile, that I think would actually probably accentuate your rationale that says that, you know, staggered boards does decrease shareholder value. The question that it comes back to is how active is the board? Because this is an entrenched management issue. I mean, boards, even in the as we've talked around in this room now for, you know, last couple of years, boards are more active today in terms of assuring that their leadership is driving value of the organization to its best point. Back in the 80s, you had a lot of imperial CEOs who just basically said, I want my job, and, you know, I'll run this company and you guys don't have a say in it. That attitude has changed dramatically, in, I think, in the Fortune 500. And so, the need for the takeover defenses decreases because the market is reflecting real value in the organization, because the leadership is driving towards real value in the organization. And we'll come back to this issue when we talk about compensation the next time around.
Let's have one more comment.
I was just wondering if you looked at other possible common factors and
trying to sort this all out. For instance, an industry bias. You'll probably see valuation gradients by, you know, that dimension. And I was also wondering, you know, did you look at the presence of separate board chairman CEO roles versus combined? You know, what kind of factor correlation is that with the conversion or transition to away from staggered boards?
Right. So your first question was about industry. Industry is a very important factor. It affects valuation because, of course, firms in different industries have very different valuations. One of the things we were very careful to do is not just control for industry, but control for the industry pairing between the firm and its customer, right? So K&R is a supplier of largely aerospace products, so it's in the aerospace industry, and so is its customer. That's a very different situation than, say, Levi's, which is a clothing manufacturer, and Walmart, which is in a retail industry. So there's an industry mismatch. So we did control for industry, but we were also very careful to control for the idea that maybe there's a mismatch of industry that we have to control for as well. And we find that the results are still significant, that the anti-takeover provisions enhance firm value even across, you know, across industries, or if they're in the same industry as well. Your other question is about looking at whether the CEO shared his role with the chair, he was also chair, or whether that was two separate people. And that's a very common control in academic research. A lot of people have suggested that it's potentially damaging to firm value to have that role combined. ISS and CalPERS and some of the other guys also don't like that dual role as well. I have I think there are mixed results on that. In my own research, we do actually look at that, along with actually many other control variables, such as CEO tenure or CEO age and those kinds of things. And that actually doesn't affect our results either. It's not really a driver when you compare it to some of the other anti-takeover provisions, particularly like staggered board. So it is an important one to control for, because at least some people suggest firms are better governed when the chair role is separate from the CEO role. We don't find that to be a large